This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Tribal Leadership, Leveraging Natural Groups to Build a Thriving Organization by Dave Logan, John King, and Haley Fisher Wright. Narrated by Stephen J. Cohen. Introduction. In less than 10 years, Zappos has grown into a company with over $1 billion in annual gross merchandise sales, while simultaneously making Fortune magazine's 100 Best Companies to Work For list, success that is driven primarily by repeat customers and word of mouth. While our brand has come to be known for delivering the very best customer service, the number one priority of the company is actually not customer service. Our priority is company culture, and our belief is that if we get the culture right, most of the other stuff, such as delivering great customer service or building an enduring brand or business, will happen as a natural byproduct of our culture. It all goes back to our belief that in the long term, a company's brand and its culture are really just two sides of the same coin. When I first stumbled upon tribal leadership, I was amazed to find a book that codified much of what we had intuitively been doing at Zappos to build our company culture. I met the authors in 2008. Shortly after the publication of the hardcover, and invited them to our headquarters in Las Vegas to experience the Zappos culture for themselves and to talk about how we could take our culture to the next level. At Zappos, we learned a lot through trial and error. I wish tribal leadership had existed prior to the founding of Zappos, as we would have saved a lot of time and heartache along the way. The principles in this book are so important to us that we even teach classes about tribal leadership to our own employees. Today, concepts and phrases from the book, such as triading and stage four behavior, have become integral parts of our culture. At Zappos, we are looking to build a long-term, sustainable, growing business, and tribal leadership is a critical piece for how we plan to do so. No matter what your company culture is like today, tribal leadership can help take it and your business to the next level, one stage at a time. Tony Hsieh, number one New York Times best-selling author of Delivering Happiness and CEO of Zappos.com, Incorporated. Forward. About 5 years ago, I had lunch with Dave Logan, then a new associate dean at USC. He was the head honcho of USC's executive development programs and had been thinking about writing a book based on his experiences teaching and consulting for top executives. Just as dessert was being served, he leaned forward to ask me a question. Who's the audience for the book I have in mind? I thought that this was the key question every author should ask, and I suggested that he learn to write for impact and for the audience of business professionals. I said that he should write about what he not only knows best, but what, in his view, would be the most important issue facing leaders, say, 5 years from now. Tribal leadership, he, John King, and Haley Fisher Wright tell me, is an outgrowth of that chat over creme brulee. The three of them have written a book that both adds to what we know about leadership and challenges some conventional wisdom. I have to confess that 5 years ago I had no idea of Dave, John, and Haley's prescience. I cannot think of a more timely book, not just for the corporate world, but for nation states as well. This book points to a fact that is so ubiquitous it's invisible. Human beings form tribes. Logan, King, and Fisher Wright point to the relationship between leadership in tribes and those who lead them. They assert that this connection raises important questions about how leaders develop, become great, and leave a legacy. As the leaders build the tribes, the leader develops the tribe. This action in turn contributes back to the leader. The leader surrenders himself to the tribe and becomes far greater than an individual alone could ever become. This book is the result of a 10-year field study of 24,000 people in 24 organizations. Instead of bringing us tables of numbers, the authors found people to epitomize their findings, giving us a book that is both interesting and informed. They learned that what separates average tribes from those that excel is culture. Furthermore, tribal culture exists in stages, going from undermining to egocentric to history-making. Their work explains why some tribes reject any discussion of values, character, or nobility, while others demand these conversations. One of the most compelling interviews is with Gordon Binder, the former CEO of Amgen. Binder is the model of what a tribal leader should be, someone who artfully builds his corporate tribes, then gets out of the way so people can achieve greatness. This work addresses several intriguing questions. Why do great leaders often fail in a new environment? Why do average leaders sometimes seem better than they really are? Why do great strategies fail more often than they succeed? The authors argue that the answer is the relationship between leaders and tribes. Great leaders build great tribes and engage in history-making efforts as they also recognize their great leaders. About 2 years ago, I watched a video of a final leadership project for a class I co-taught with then USC President Stephen Sample. One of the student groups raised funds to fly high school students from economically disadvantaged neighborhoods to Sacramento to be trained by leaders in the California state government. While there, they worked with John King. The video highlighted King's message, which was that a leader's behavior is shaped by an unwavering commitment to personal and tribal values. The students were moved as they found ways to become leaders of their own tribes. The insights in this book don't just have the power to change organizations. They can touch the human heart. That makes them very powerful indeed. Warren Bennis. Part 1. The Tribal Leadership System. Chapter 1. Corporate Tribes. Every organization is really a set of small towns. If you're from a small town, think of the people there. If you're not, think of, as Don Henley sings, that same small town in each of us. There are the business executive and the sheriff. There's the town scandal, the preacher's wife, and the school teacher. There's talk of who will be the next mayor, who will move away, and the price of grain or oil or the Walmart starting wage. There's the high school, where the popular kid, the son of the town's sheriff, throws a party the weekend his father is away. There are the church crowd, the bar friends, the single people, the book club, the bitter enemies. There are also the ones who are the natural leaders, who explain why the party at the sheriff's house seemed like a good idea at the time, and how sorry they are for the beer stains on the carpet. The people are different in every town, and the roles are never exactly the same. But there are more similarities than differences, and the metaphor itself always holds. From companies in Nebraska to ones in New York or Kuala Lumpur, we call these small towns tribes, and they form so naturally it's as though our tribe is part of our genetic code. Tribes helped humans survive the last ice age, build farming communities and later cities. Birds flock, fish school, people tribe. A tribe is a group between 20 and 150 people. Here's the test for whether someone is in one of your tribes. If you saw her walking down the street, you'd stop and say hello. The members of your tribe are probably programmed into your cell phone and in your email address book. The 150 number comes in part from Robin Dunbar's research, which was popularized in Malcolm Gladwell's The Tipping Point. When a tribe approaches this number, it naturally splits into two tribes. Some of the corporate tribes we've seen include the high-potential managers of one of the world's largest financial services companies, the doctors, nurses, and administrators of one of America's most respected healthcare institutions, the research and development division of a mammoth high-tech firm, the operational executives of a major drug company, and the students of the executive MBA program at the University of Southern California. Tribes in companies get work done, sometimes a lot of work, but they don't form because of work. Tribes are the basic building block of any large human effort, including earning a living. As such, their influence is greater than that of teams, entire companies, and even superstar CEOs. In companies, tribes decide whether the new leader is going to flourish or get taken out. They determine how much work gets done and of what quality. Some tribes demand excellence for everyone and are constantly evolving. Others are content to do the minimum to get by. What makes the difference in performance? Tribal leaders. Tribal leaders focus their efforts on building the tribe, or more precisely, upgrading the tribal culture. If they are successful, the tribe recognizes them as the leaders, giving them top effort, cult-like loyalty, and a track record of success. Divisions and companies run by tribal leaders set the standard of performance in their industries. From productivity and profitability to employee retention, they are talent magnets, with people so eager to work for the leader that they will take a pay cut if necessary. Tribal leaders receive so many promotions in such a short time that people often spread buzz that they will be the next CEO. Their efforts seem effortless, leaving many people puzzled by how they do it. Many tribal leaders, if asked, can't articulate what they are doing that's different, but after listening to this book, you will be able to explain and duplicate their success. A tribal leader many of us know from history is George Washington. His single major contribution was in changing 13 diverse colonies into one people. If we look into what Washington actually did, he built a single identity, measurable by what people said, to a series of networked tribes. One was the affluent class in Virginia society, perhaps fewer than 100 people. Another was the Continental Congress, originally 55 delegates. The third was the officer class of the Continental Army. Each time, Washington led the group to unity by recognizing its tribalness, by getting its members to talk about what unified them, valuing freedom, hating the king's latest tax, or wanting to win the fight. As he built the common cause in each tribe, a mission gelled and they embraced "We're great" language. Washington's brilliance in each case was that the man and the cause became synonymous with the leader, shaping the tribe and the tribe calling forth the leader. This is how tribal leadership works. The leader upgrades the tribe as the tribe embraces the leader. Tribes and leaders create each other. Before we move on, a few words about our method. We're at the end of a 10-year set of research studies that involved 24,000 people in 24 organizations with members around the world. We derived each concept, tip, and principle in this book from this research. What moved us, and what we hope moves you, is not the statistical side of the analysis, but the people we met along the way. People who live the principles, who make life better for millions of employees, customers, and residents of their communities. As a result, we've written this book around the individuals who moved us. Our guiding metaphor is this. Most popular business books are like log cabins, cozy and warm with a blazing fire. They're comfortable, life-affirming, and filled with snapshots of people and moments. They're fun to read, and the principles in them resonate within our experiences as true. The log cabin is built on anecdotes, however, and as we look back to 50 years of them, many have collapsed as times and economic cycles change. Although comfortable, they need structural reinforcement. Another set of books rests on statistical evidence, and while we trust their conclusions, reading them is like visiting a skyscraper with cubicles built in the 1970s, containing steel desks under fluorescent lights that flicker. Their structural integrity stands up during storms, but we find being in them tiring and draining. We have attempted to put together a book that has the structural integrity of the skyscraper, but with Persian rugs, cherry wood tables, floor-to-ceiling windows, perhaps even a stone fireplace or two. In short, you'll be hearing about people, but with the assurance that the principles behind the stories are based on research. In presenting our findings, we have done our best to avoid academic concepts like theoretic frameworks and research agendas. When it was necessary to bring in others' research, we went and sat with them, when possible, to bring their personalities into the story, as well as their findings. When our research gave us solid conclusions, we sought out people who epitomized what we were seeing in the data, to give a human face to the main points of this book. As you take this journey with us, you'll meet former Amgen CEO Gordon Binder, NASCAR chairman Brian France, IDEO founder Dave Kelly, Gallup CEO Jim Clifton, authors Ken Wilber and Don Beck, Dilbert creator Scott Adams, actress Carol Burnett, Nobel laureate Danny Kahneman, and Mike Ruzione, captain of the 1980 Olympic gold medal U.S. hockey team, the basis of the movie Miracle. We are indebted to these individuals and many others, and to a lineage of research that is fairly new to business. If you want to see the academic side of our research, you might start with Appendix B, which is about the story of our methodology. Simply put, it's that tribes emerge from the language people use to describe themselves, their jobs, and others. For most people, language is something they just live with and don't think about. Tribal leaders know how to nudge language in a way that makes it morph. Just as Washington's efforts created a common tribal language in the colonies, the army, and the Continental Congress, change the language in the tribe, and you have changed the tribe itself. As we derived principles and tools, we put them to work in companies and organizations that were willing to test new methods, some worked, and some failed. We folded these lessons learned back into our studies so that what you're listening to has a basis in both research and practical experience. A roadmap to tribal leadership. Most people describe tribal leadership as a journey in which they understand themselves and the people around them better, and, as a result, know exactly what actions will affect their workplaces. Most people are blind to tribal dynamics. Our clients have described the moment when it all clicked for them, when they were able to see their company as a tribe, and suddenly they saw exactly what to do. In the same way George Washington somehow knew what to do more than 200 years ago. The first part of this book will give you the insights and vocabulary of a tribal leader. Chapter 2 introduces the main thrust of this book, tribal stages. The tribal stages operate like a slow conveyor belt that keeps sticking. When the belt is moving, people naturally move from one stage to the next. The early chapters in this book will remind you of the early stages of your career, the days right after college when you didn't know people and it was hard to find traction for your ideas. You'll recognize some clusters of people who have gotten stuck at this stage and built their part of the tribe accordingly. The vast majority of people become stuck in the middle stages, then seek out tribes that speak their language and do things in a familiar way. The later chapters will describe you on your best days and give you insight into people you know who can make things happen wherever they go. After the five stages are introduced, later chapters go into each stage, highlighting exactly what action will affect it and how to know when you're succeeding. Because each stage has a unique set of leverage points that will unstick it, it's critical to understand each one. Apply the leverage points incorrectly, and you'll reinforce tribal mediocrity. This book is written at three different levels. First is the story, the main text of the book. Second are the technical notes in the margins, which answer the many questions we've been asked as we explain the tribal leadership system. Those of you who like detail and fine gradations, we hope, will find these points useful. Third are the coaching tips, which are specific steps that will accomplish the main goals of the chapter. Also, if you like summaries, turn to Appendix A, a cheat sheet for tribal leaders. It gives the key action steps that will help you build great tribes. We've written this book to share everything we've learned along the way. The goal of this book is for you to become a tribal leader without our help. The lessons we offer are ones we observed around us, so we believe we are students of tribal leadership, the same as everyone. That said, we hope you'll share your successes and failures with us so that we can learn with you. Appendix C gives our contact information. What we learn from you we'll make available through our website, triballeadership.net. Articles, classes, many of them through universities, and speeches. The goal of tribal leadership. The goal of this book is to give you the perspective and tools of a tribal leader, someone who can unstick the conveyor belt and make it run faster for whole groups of people no matter which stage they're in. The result is more effective workplaces, greater strategic success, less stress, and more fun. In short, the point of this book is for you to build a better organization in which the best people want to work and make an impact. The means to building great organizations is the use of these leverage points, which are ways of unsticking people so that they naturally glide to the next stage. Unstick enough people, and you've swapped one set of tribal dynamics for a higher performing set and a more capable tribe. Each stage gets more done and has more fun than the one before it. The ultimate expression of tribal leadership is companies filled with people who know how to unstick themselves and others, a tribe of tribal leaders. We now turn to the main thrust of how to build greater organizations, the five tribal stages. Key points from this chapter. A tribe is any group of people between about 20 and 150 who know each other enough that if they saw each other walking down the street, would stop and say hello. They are likely people in your cell phone and in your email address book. A small company is a tribe, and a large company is a tribe of tribes. Chapter 2. The Five Tribal Stages. Entering Griffin Hospital in Derby, Connecticut is like going to Nordstrom's for healthcare. The first clue that this isn't a normal healthcare company is the valet who squeegees car windows and knows many patients by name. Walk through the front entrance, and the first thing you notice is piano music, soft and elegant, coming from the baby grand in a niche just beside the front door. The second thing you notice is the smell, fresh flowers and wood. In recent years, Griffin has drawn international attention as not only a great hospital but a great employer, ranking fourth on the Fortune list of best places to work in its seventh year on that list. There are many heroes in the Griffin Hospital story, but two stand out as tribal leaders because their efforts have gone a long way to upgrade the tribal culture. The first is President and CEO Patrick Charmel, tall, lean, mid-40s, dark hair, soft-spoken, self-effacing, a caring tone in his voice. He seems a cross between a high-tech entrepreneur and a priest. Charmel started with Griffin as an intern while attending a local university, then went to Yale for his Master of Public Health degree, and returned as a full-time employee. "Some people still remember me as someone who is 19 years old," he says. "No matter what their position, they don't mind telling me when I mess up." The second hero is Vice President Bill Pawanda, mid-60s, gray, fast-talking and charming. He is easily moved by the human side of the story. Although Griffin has many lines of communication with the community, Pawanda is the perfect person to carry the flame to the outside world. He was born at Griffin and is a former state senator and former board chairman of the local Chamber of Commerce. Charmel started as Pawanda's intern, and they have worked together for 28 years. Today's success is far different from what longtime Griffin employees call the perfect storm of the mid-1980s, when the hospital had the oldest physical plant in the state, falling patient satisfaction and market share, and difficulty recruiting staff and physicians. The community was transforming from a manufacturing town in decline to a bedroom community with an influx of young, educated, mobile residents with higher expectations for their health care. Griffin's board authorized a community perception survey and asked local residents this question: "If there is a hospital you'd avoid, please name it." Of those who responded, 32% hand-wrote Griffin. The hospital, it seemed, was doomed, and without any resources to stop the death spiral. As we see again and again with tribal leaders, Charmel and Pawanda didn't save the hospital Superman style, swooping in to save the day. Rather, they galvanized the tribe of employees, volunteers, board members, and community leaders whose opinions mattered and the turnaround was a tribal effort. In a sense, Charmel didn't lead it. He nudged it, and then was led by it, and he humbly credits the entire Griffin team for its success. "Our success really is a testament to our culture," he said. "Looking back, it's clear that we never could have accomplished this without engaging our employees and getting them involved in the process. I think that's what distinguishes the approach. It started with the question whether Griffin should remain independent or join another healthcare system." Pawanda, glancing out the window of his office, says, "We are a fiercely independent and competitive community, and people are used to getting everything they need here, from shopping to church." As Griffin administrators went through their options, several executives had their own personal perfect storms. Charmel's father had open-heart surgery at a New Jersey hospital. Another vice president was hospitalized after a car accident. Pawanda's father-in-law was admitted to Griffin with inoperable stomach cancer. Although the cancer was stable, he was bleeding from what the physician said were inoperable ulcers located behind the tumors. For over 30 days, he sat in the critical care unit. "He lost blood, and they'd put it back in," Pawanda told us, and after 37 days, his surgeon said, "Today's the day we shut off your blood supply." The patient's wife went after him with her cane, shouting, "Don't ever come back to this room again." The family and their longtime primary care doctor finally convinced a young surgeon to attempt to suture off the ulcer. The surgery was successful, and the man went home and lived another 14 months before succumbing to the cancer. "The experience was a personal life-altering event," Pawanda recalled. "It became a passion to ensure that others avoided a similar experience by creating a more humane and patient-sensitive care model for the patient and family." Griffin decided to remain independent and to rebuild itself into a hospital that would put the patient first, one operation at a time. Griffin executives focused the staff on the problem and facilitated their finding the solution. A board member argued that if the institution created satisfied patients in the maternity ward, Griffin would keep many of them for years. But what did they want? "Let's ask them," the board member advised. "We went on a marketing research tear," Pawanda said. "We were pioneers in the industry." Griffin launched surveys and focus groups, and Charmel and a staff member posed as husband and pregnant wife, thanks to a pillow, and toured maternity wards at nearby hospitals. "We put together a long list of what young parents wanted," Pawanda recalled. "It included a separate hospital entrance, since expectant mothers said they weren't sick and didn't want to be around sick people. Double beds, a jacuzzi for pain relief and early labor, family rooms with kitchens, 24/7 visiting hours, fresh flowers, a spa-like atmosphere, and personalized treatment by Pleasant staff." With this long list in hand, the executives sat down to prioritize the enhancements they would offer. In a move that revealed Charmel's tribal orientation, he stopped the process and asked, an atypical edge in his voice, "What are we doing?" After an awkward moment, he continued, "We know what they want. Let's give it all to them." Griffin's leaders agreed, and design work started on a maternity ward that would set the new standard in the Northeast. The challenge was to involve the staff as partners, in the same way that the executives and board members were collaborating. Instead of telling employees the new vision, Charmel, then assistant to the president, and other executives, led a series of all-day staff retreats, taking 1/12 of the employees at a time. In the morning, one of the executives would describe the perfect storm. Then they would ask the staff to take the perspective of patients and to answer the question, What would you want your hospital experience to be? As Pawanda says, lo and behold, they described a scene dramatically different from Griffin and the nation's hospitals. Open visiting, more information about their medical condition, caring staff, and they were the staff. It was an awakening for everyone. Almost every one of the 12 groups came up with the same list of what they'd want, and the chatter at the hospital began to turn toward quality, service, respect, and dignity, now the pillars of Griffin's core values. During one part of the new building design process, Charmel suggested that Griffin build a full-scale mock-up of the critical components of the new design in a warehouse. Staff members all made suggestions on small slips of paper, eventually giving hundreds of recommendations to the architects. To this day, people will point to a wall outlet and say, "It used to be over there until I suggested they move it," Pawanda adds. Charmel, promoted to COO, clashed with the CEO, who thought the solution for Griffin was to focus on its wholly owned HMO. Charmel disagreed with the transfer of financial resources from Griffin Hospital to support growth of the HMO. This shift was thwarting patient service and damaging Griffin's ability to fulfill its mission. The fight resulted in Charmel's termination. With the popular COO fired, a revolution began. An underground employee newsletter appeared, urging staff members to wear a yellow ribbon, save Griffin, and bring back Pat, Charmel. After 3 months of turmoil, including petitions, votes of no confidence, and community meetings, the board, acting on advice from consultants and an investigation committee, asked the CEO and executive vice president to resign. The board asked Charmel to return. On the day Charmel came back to Griffin, now as interim CEO, over 400 staff members, volunteers, community leaders, and members of the press welcomed him back with a surprise reception at the hospital entrance filled with yellow balloons. It was an emotional, tribal moment for Griffin. The level of loyalty to Griffin and Charmel is stunning. It survived the layoffs that followed his return, difficult decisions including closing the money-losing HMO, and even a potential panic after the nation's fifth anthrax death at Griffin in 2001. As a result, so many people want to see the Griffin miracle that the hospital now charges visitors from other hospitals who want to use the Griffin's patient-centered care model within their organization. Teams representing almost 600 hospitals have paid to see Griffin for themselves. The U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services appointed Charmel to the National Advisory Council for Research and Quality in 2005. Charmel's office features 7 years of Fortune magazine best employer covers. Charmel is blunt in his belief that it is the employees who have put Griffin on the Fortune list as a result of their pride in the organization and their dedication to those Griffin serves. Pawanda's office features pictures of himself with Bill Clinton and Colin Powell, as well as a Toga Man of the Year award from the Connecticut Senate for outstanding civic and community service. Both men turn the credit back to the tribe, which Pawanda says includes not only the Griffin family, but the community as well. When we asked Charmel about his greatest achievement, it took several seconds of thought before he answered. When he did, he said, "Seeing people live the philosophy. They are my inspiration." Tribal leadership up close. What did Charmel and Pawanda do that was different from what most leaders do? First, They spent most of their efforts building strong relationships between Griffin's tribal members, its employees, volunteers, and patients. Second, instead of telling people what to do, they engineered experiences, such as the retreats, in which staff members would look at the same issues they were dealing with, so that strategy became everyone's problem. Third, they got out of the way and let people contribute in their own way to the emerging tribal goals. Most important and hardest to see, they unstuck Griffin's tribal culture and nudged it forward, stage by stage, until people charged after problems with the zeal of converts, not the indifference of hired guns. In a sentence, this is what Sharmell and Pawanda did. They built the tribe, and as they did, people recognized them as leaders. The more Sharmell and Pawanda put the tribe first, the more people respected and identified them, giving their efforts more credibility and impact. This is tribal leadership in a nutshell, and what you'll be able to do after mastering the principles in this book. A visitor who talks with Griffin leaders and staff hears what sounds like false modesty. Sharmell and Pawanda are adamant that the praise should go to the employees, while people at all levels credit these two and many others with the success. Who is right? Tribal leadership says both. Without the leaders building the tribe, a culture of mediocrity will prevail. Without an inspired tribe, leaders are impotent. Today, when patients come in, they aren't treated as customers, but rather as members of the tribe. Doctors build relationships between patients and nurses. Administrators bring people together and allow the tribe to decide what's best. Years after the perfect storm passed, Griffin is a hospital with wall-to-wall leaders. Every tribe has a dominant culture, which we can peg on a 1-to-5 scale, with the goal being stability at stage 4 and on occasion leaps to stage 5. All things being equal, a 5 culture will always outperform a 4 culture, which will outperform a 3, and so on. Stage 5 is unstable, but can produce history-making innovations. People and groups move only one stage at a time, and the actions that advance people from stage 1 to stage 2 are different from those that advance them from 2 to 3, since each stage has a unique set of leverage points that will nudge people forward. Most of the universal principles from the log cabin management books work in only one stage. Try them in another stage and your efforts will fail. If tribes are the most powerful vehicles within companies, cultures are their engines. Sharmell and Pawanda inherited a set of overlapping tribes. Remember, a tribe is at most 150 people, with an engine in need of repair. In tribal leadership language, they had dominant stage 2 cultures. The leaders unstuck people and guided them to a 3. They used a different set of leverage points to bump people to a 4. On its best days, and Griffin has many best days, it operates at a 5. Each culture has its own way of speaking, or theme, that appears whenever people talk, email, joke around, or just pass one another in the hallway. Griffin reveals its tribal cultures when the valet remembers people's names and when the nurses introduce patients to doctors as if they were introducing dear friends. After listening to the first part of this book, you'll be able to hear these themes anytime two people have even a single conversation. We now turn to the 5 tribal stages in detail. Stage 1. Fortunately, most professionals skip stage 1. Only about 2% of American professionals operate here at any given point, which is the mindset that creates street gangs and people who come to work with shotguns. If people at Stage 1 had t-shirts, they would read "Life sucks," and what comes out of their mouths supports this adage. People at this stage are despairingly hostile, and they band together to get ahead in a violent and unfair world. Although most people reading this book will not have been in Stage 1, they've seen it on The Shawshank Redemption. Most anthropologists say that human society started at Stage 1, clans scratching out an existence while fighting with one another. We're not going in depth on this stage because organizations usually don't hire Stage 1 individuals, and when they do, they are quick to expel them. Chapter 4 goes into what you need to know about Stage 1, how to spot it, and how to assist people in it to move forward. We've consulted to several organizations with Stage 1 tribes. One disappeared after a series of accounting scandals. Another had constant problems with employees stealing money, seemingly without remorse. A third was so stressed out that no one was surprised when an employee came to work with a shotgun. Stage 2. In 25% of workplace tribes, the dominant culture is Stage 2, which is a quantum leap from Stage 1. People operating at Stage 2 use language centered on "my life sucks." People in this cultural stage are passively antagonistic. They cross their arms in judgment, yet never really get interested enough to spark any passion. Their laughter is quietly sarcastic and resigned. The Stage 2 talk is that they've seen it all before and watched it all fail. A person at Stage 2 will often try to protect his or her people from the intrusion of management. The mood that results from Stage 2's theme, "My life sucks," is a cluster of apathetic victims. If you've ever walked into a meeting and presented a new idea with passion, only to get back looks of passivity, you've probably walked into a Stage 2 culture. Stage 2 is what we see when we watch The Office or walk into the Department of Motor Vehicles. There is little to no innovation and almost no sense of urgency, and people almost never hold one another accountable for anything. During the perfect storm at Griffin, the company had a dominant Stage 2 culture. Most large companies have pockets of Stage 2, often divisions that don't have an impact on strategy or direction. Although Stage 2 can appear in any discipline, we've seen it most often in human resources, procurement, and accounting. That said, we've also seen Stage 2 in boards of directors, executive suites, sales, and operations. Years ago, we consulted to an agency of the United States government. When we showed up, employees and managers would stand in their doors of their offices and entrances to their cubicles, looking out at a shared hallway. People looked as if they'd just woke up, and many had. They would hold coffee mugs, flaunting messages like, "I'd rather be fishing," and "I live for the weekends." No amount of team building, motivational speeches, discussions of core values, or new strategic plans would make any difference with this tribe. It was solidly locked in Stage 2. As a result, very little got done. The tribe produced few new ideas and almost never followed them up. The focus of tribal leadership is to move Stage 2 to 3 before asking anything new of the group. Chapter 5 gives the leverage points. Stage 3. The theme of Stage 3, the dominant culture in 49% of workplace tribes in the United States, is "I'm great." Or more fully, "I'm great and you're not." Normally, doctors operate at this level on their best days, as do professors, attorneys, and salespeople. Within the Stage 3 culture, knowledge is power, so people hoard it. From client contacts to gossip about the company, people at Stage 3 have to win, and for them, winning is personal. They'll outwork and outthink their competitors on an individual basis. The mood that results is a collection of lone warriors wanting help and support and being continually disappointed that others don't have their ambition or skill, because they have to do the tough work, remembering that others just aren't as savvy. Their complaint is that they don't have enough time or competent support. Technical note. At each cultural stage, there is a specific fingerprint made up of language that people use and observable behavior toward others in the tribe. These two almost always correlate perfectly. As a result of lots of people operating together at this cultural stage, a certain mood results. People trained in tribal leadership, and you are on your way to being one of them, can detect this mood within a few minutes of walking into a work group. The gravity that holds people at Stage 3 is the addictive hit they get from winning, besting others, being the smartest and most successful. Before we judge people at this stage as having big egos, we have to remember that society made them, us, this way. From the time we enter school, the one who knows 2 + 2 = 4 gets a gold star. Then it's our ABCs and a smiley face, an algebra test, and an A+, SATs, an admission into Stanford, letters of recommendation and an MBA, a great interview and a job offer, and an almost post-coital glow of success. If 30 years of reinforcement aren't enough, go to Barnes & Noble and look over the books in the business section. From Machiavelli to Robert Greene's The 48 Laws of Power, to anything with Donald Trump's picture on it, helping people get to and maintain Stage 3 is a multi-billion dollar industry. Once Griffin moved people to the point where they took individual responsibility for crafting a patient experience, they had moved to Stage 3. Like most professionals, our careers have been spent in and among Stage 3. It's most common in pockets of companies where success is measured on an individual basis, in sales and among executives. We've seen it in architecture, real estate, healthcare, law, and a place we know very well, the university. A typical faculty meeting shows the limitation of Stage 3. One professor after another gives his opinion and says what he thinks should be done. The result is that most educational programs look as if they had been designed by a committee, because they were. Students often ask if faculty ever speak to one another, and the answer is not often, at least about important topics. People show up, do their individual research, teach their classes in a manner described by IDEO's David Kelly as a sage on stage, and then leave. Staff members often gripe that professors see only their little corner of the world, and in many cases, the criticism is legitimate. Organizations run by Stage 3 behavior feel dehumanizing. As one former aerospace manager told us, "I thought I was loved until I left. Now I don't even get a Christmas card from anyone." As with Stage 2, no amount of team building will turn this group of self-described star players into a team. Give it a new strategy and tribal members will show either that they embrace it more than others or that they don't need it. Again, the focus of tribal leadership is to upgrade the tribal culture first. Chapters 6 and 7 give the leverage points for Stage 3. Stage 4. The gulf between I'm Great, Stage 3, and We're Great, Stage 4, is huge. Grand Canyon huge. This level represents 22% of workplace tribal cultures, where the theme of people's communication is We're Great. Although Griffin spikes into Stage 5, it is mostly a Stage 4 company. When two people at the hospital meet in the hallways, they're excited about being with another member of the tribe. Take the tribe away, and the person's sense of self suffers a loss. As we watch, Bill Pawanda is fully himself, and people are fully themselves. No corporate cult here. Everyone seems happy, inspired, and genuine. You see it on people's faces as Charmel works the room, and it's equally true that the room works Charmel. Leading a tribe with a dominant Stage 4 culture, the leader feels pulled by the group. At times, tribal leadership at this stage is effortless. A most impressive characteristic and display of confidence, as we toured Griffin, was that everybody, staff, volunteers, doctors, made eye contact with us, behavior that is highly unusual in medicine. As we watch a Griffin meeting from a distance, the overall vibe of the room is tribal pride, which is the mood that results from the Stage 4 culture. A We're Great tribe always has an adversary. The need for it is hardwired into the DNA of this cultural stage. In fact, the full expression of the theme is We're Great and They're Not. For USC football, the you're not is usually UCLA, and in good years, whichever team is contending for the national championship. For Apple's operating system engineers, it's Microsoft. Often, it's another group within the company. A tribe will seek its own competitor, and the only one who has influence over the target is the tribal leader. Pawanda has argued that Griffin's only worthy competitor is the entire way of doing business in healthcare. The rule for Stage 4 is this: the bigger the foe, the more powerful the tribe. Griffin would not be the success it is if it were to target a single hospital as its rival. People often ask Charmel and Pawanda how they can lead the way they do. The real answer is, lead by building a Stage 4 critical mass culture in the tribe, and then they'll recognize you as a leader. The other part of the answer is to remember that these are consecutive stages. So attempt to build a Griffin-style culture only with people who are already at Stage 3. Charmel and Pawanda had to move the tribe from Stage 2 to 3 before instilling the We're Great hallmarks of 4. We will show how this is done in later chapters. Chapter 8 is the realm of tribal leadership. When groups get to this point, they see themselves as a tribe with a common purpose. They commit to shared core values and hold one another accountable. They will not tolerate the office-style performance or the personal agenda of Stage 3. Fully three-quarters of tribes operate below Stage 4, and those in the zone of tribal leadership haven't stabilized at this level. As a result, they oscillate in and out of I'm Great, Stage 3. The purpose of this book is to build great companies, and this means getting you and your tribe to Stage 4. Since tribes move only one stage at a time, only those at 4 can make leaps into the most advanced stage. Technical note: in the West, the word tribe is increasingly being used to represent a social unit, bigger than a group, but smaller than a society. That is how we're using the word. Many people who have done work in Africa, including Spiral Dynamics author Don Beck, cautioned us against the use of the word tribal. Having been to Africa, we understand the concern. Tribalism, in a different sense than we mean the term, has been responsible for torture, war, and genocide. To be clear, tribal leadership for us means stage four, a culture based on a "We're Great" language screen emphasizing shared core values and interdependent strategies. Tribalism, as the word is often used in parts of the developing world, refers to the violence and despairing hostility of stage one. Ethnic cleansing and other horrors are inconceivable in a stage four tribe. Stage five. Stage four is a launching pad for stage five. When we explain this last stage, which reflects less than 2% of workplace tribal cultures, we see skeptical looks coming back at us. Stage 5's t-shirt would read, "Life is great," and they haven't been doing illicit substances. Their language revolves around infinite potential and how the group is going to make history. Not to beat a competitor, but because doing so will make a global impact. This group's mood is innocent wonderment, with people in competition with what's possible, not another tribe. Teams at Stage 5 have produced miraculous innovations. The team that produced the first Macintosh was at Stage 5, and we've seen this mood at Amgen. This stage is pure leadership, vision, and inspiration. After a short burst of activity, Stage 5 teams recede to Stage 4 to regroup and attend to infrastructure issues before possibly returning to 5. In sports, these bursts win Olympic gold and Super Bowl rings. In business, these explosions of leadership make history. Griffin is a model for the best organizations in the world as its culture oscillates between stage 4 and stage 5. You can take the person out of the tribe. In the Austin Powers movies, Mini-Me was always a loyal follower. But you had to keep up with who had his loyalty. When backing Dr. Evil, Mini-Me would stop at nothing to kill or harass Austin Powers. When his allegiance switched to Austin, our little hero then attempted to take out his old master's influence. It might be said that we are all Mini-Me's for the cultures that dominate our tribes. When a person soaks long enough in a Stage 3 tribe, she becomes an ambassador for that culture, even when moved to other environments. At the same time, the culture the person soaked in was shaped by her influence. People's default stage and the cultures around them mold each other. Over time, the language the person speaks and that of the tribal stage sync up. You might say that Mini-Me and his boss shape each other. We can predict the performance of the tribe by counting the number of people who speak the language of each stage and noticing who is in positions of leadership. The one factor that makes Griffin extraordinary after its turnaround is the high number of Stage 4 people who talk Stage 4 language. If someone at Griffin were to talk the language of Stage 1 or 2, the tribe would reject that person. When the old CEO fired Charmel, the tribe refused to accept the decision. That's the power of tribes. They accept who we are, or they mold us. If we reject their advice, they ostracize us. Very few people have the ability to change a tribe's dominant stage. Those people are tribal leaders. Most companies we've seen have tribes that are mixtures of stages 2, 3, and 4, with most people hovering around the dividing line between "My Life Sucks," stage 2, and I'm great, stage 3. Here's what results. A battle ensues between the personal agenda-driven people at stage 3 and the vision-driven people who talk stage 4, with those at stage 2 largely sitting back to see who wins. Executives get frustrated that change is so hard to implement. Senior managers read Jack Welch's books and fire the bottom 10% of performers. Amazingly, people just redistribute to the stages as other people leave. The company buys hundreds of copies of Who Moved My Cheese? Or sends its people to time management training. On top of this tribal chatter, the CEO fights to make quarterly earnings, and the head of human resources wonders why trust and communication are always the weak points on the climate survey. People complain about all the politics around here, but despite money spent on training and time spent away from work, things never seem to change. So far, we've seen that people always form tribes, and that the dominant culture stage determines effectiveness. The way to move the entire tribe's performance to the next level is to move the critical mass to the next stage. This process involves moving many people forward individually by facilitating them to use a different language and to shift their behavior accordingly. As that happens, the tribe itself will produce a new self-sustaining culture. When it gets to stage 4, like Griffin, it won't tolerate people who talk stage 3 or below. Each person in this tribe is on a journey through the stages, and the tribe makes that journey long or short. The job of you as tribal leader is to expedite this journey for each person, so that a new critical mass forms at stage 4. When that happens, the tribe will see itself as a tribe, just as Griffin does, and embrace you as the leader. This is tribal leadership in a nutshell. When we refer to working with individuals in this book, we do not mean changing their beliefs, attitudes, motivation, or ideas, or anything else that isn't directly observable. Tribal leadership focuses on two things, and only two things: the words people use, and the types of relationships they form. We'll warn you now, there is one exception to this rule, which is in stage 5. Moving a person from one stage to the next means intervening in a certain way to help this person change her language and set up different types of relationships. As that happens to one person and then another, the entire tribe goes through a change as a new cultural stage becomes dominant. We call these ways of intervening leverage points, and they are summarized in Appendix A for all 5 cultural stages. Technical note. Unlike most researchers, we weren't interested in where people came from, what psychologists call their socioeconomic status. We ignored their age, gender, income, and ethnicity. As our research base expanded to include people in Asia, Europe, and Africa, we even ignored people's native language. We didn't profile their personality type, measure their IQ, or ask them about their educational level. Rather, our research stems from an ancient way of understanding people, that they, we, create our reality with language. Appendix B gives the full version of this story, including the scholars we're indebted to, but for now it's enough to say this. When a person looks out at the world, he sees it filtered through a screen of his words, and this process is as invisible to him as water is to fish. We see the world and our words in one impression, as if we're looking at a forest through a green filter. We can't see what's really green and what's not. If we were to walk around with the filter in our eye long enough, we'd forget it was there, and life would just be green. A Journey Through the Stages. People come to this book at various stages, and that's natural.